Morning, welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on February 3rd, 2026, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Julieta L. Mercado, Vice President virtually, Commissioner Tony Olson, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Colin Wildenbrock, our Chief Operating Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or the electronic devices at this time. This time I will do the flag salute. You are welcome to join me. Copies of the agenda are located on the empty clerk's table near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
I have none.
Comments from the public is item two on today's agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and persons shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up cards located at the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial *9 if by phone. I will call on you to speak at the appropriate time. If you're calling in on your phone, you will need to dial *6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please stand up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name, and indicate where you're from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents or other materials to enter into the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk, who will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So first, agenda item one, our employee of the month for February, Matt Benson. Matt, go ahead.
Maybe.
You've got a lot of energy this morning.
Okay. Is that good? Okay. Good morning. My name is Amanda Bowman. I'm just in the HR department. And I just want to thank you all for joining us today as we celebrate one of our own, Matt Benson, February's Employee of the Month. This is a really special moment to recognize someone who truly embodies what it means to be part of Team. I'm so grateful to be given time to share with you what makes Matt so worthy. One of Matt's most remarkable qualities is his commitment to the team. So for that reason, we're going all in on the Team Matt theme. Now, if you know Matt, you know he has a passion for team sports. More specifically, his enthusiasm for the Washington State Cougars exemplifies his can-do attitude and inspires others, even bridging college rivalries. Several Huskies supporters have joined in wearing Cougar gear as a nod to Matt's influence. I bleed purple. Matt is a highly regarded HR professional who consistently demonstrates exceptional dedication to the district priorities and values. Leaders from across the district regularly reach out to Matt directly because they value his opinion, his expertise, and his thoughtful perspective. Matt has supported managers and employees as they have navigated a variety of sometimes really challenging issues. Recently, he's graciously stepped up to onboard a new employee to the employee relations team. Matt made the new team member feel welcomed and valued by openly sharing knowledge, answering questions with patience, and making himself available to help. Matt is a dream to manage. He models the behaviors we expect of all employees: grace, respect, kindness. Last year, after some department changes, Matt volunteered to take on a larger role on the labor relations team. He used his experience on the most recent labor negotiations subcommittee team to continue to provide the high level of customer service and collaboration that labor and management believe is essential to take us into the future. As many of you may know, Matt played a pivotal role in the successful rollout of the employee engagement survey. Matt has a passion for this work, getting meaningful feedback from employees so the district can focus resources and continuously improve together. He works to actively support managers by answering questions and communicating the importance of responding effectively to the feedback employees share. Matt has spent countless hours behind the scenes to communicate, educate, and encourage employees to participate in the employee engagement survey. I'm happy to report that this work resulted in a total participation rate of 72%, which is a 4.2% increase from the previous survey. Matt has a distinct style that fosters open communication, ensuring that all voices are heard, and enables the departments to turn ideas into action. His efforts over recent years have contributed to meaningful district-wide improvements and have sparked positive changes throughout the district with a lasting impact on our culture. Matt's intelligence stands out in every project he takes on. He's not only tackling his day-to-day responsibilities, he's also finishing his PhD in general psychology with a focus on industrial and organizational psychology. His insight and problem-solving skills have been a game changer for our team, helping us find new solutions and move forward together. What truly sets Matt apart is his gentle and kind nature. He's the person you turn to when you need support, a steady hand, or just someone to listen. Whether he realizes it or not, Matt makes every colleague feel heard and valued. His empathy and professionalism make him approachable and a trusted resource across the district. His thoughtful leadership earns respect and fosters a positive environment. Those who work with Matt see him as a quiet leader, someone who people want to listen to. When not working, Matt enjoys spending time with his 8-month-old Hawaiian poodle, Farley. Honestly, it's been so much fun to watch Matt step into the role of being a proud and sometimes exhausted dog dad. In addition to walking Farley, Matt loves to hit the gym every day. Yep, every day. How does he manage to stay energized for his job, studies, and workouts? Well, the key to fitting all these activities into his day isn't a secret to those he works closely with. He relies on a few rock star energy drinks each day to keep going. Matt approaches most situations with a shy smile, thoughtful engagement, and emotional intelligence. His steady presence provides guidance when we need it most. He's consistent, reliable, fair, and always ready to help. Whether it's supporting managers or assisting a team member through a challenge, Matt's approach lifts everyone up. I challenge all of us to be a bit more like Matt. Find ways to support building a culture where we recognize one another's achievements, unite around common goals, and honor our differences, even when that means wearing coupe gear. Thank you, Matt. Thank you for your dedication, your collaborative spirit, and your unwavering integrity. You're a role model for us all. On behalf of Team PUD, congratulations on this well-deserved recognition. We're grateful to have you with us, and we look forward to all that you'll continue to achieve. Matt, it is truly an honor to get to work with you. Okay, I think, is it photo op? Okay, photo op time.
You have to come up to the podium. Congratulations, thank you.
Congratulations. Have we met before? Anyway, well,
nice to meet you. So, Matt, we're going to talk to Matt first. Matt, the commission focuses so much when we have employee recognition on helping our customers. But to help our customers, we have to have a great team. Your work in human resources to make our organization better, to build a better team, to support our employees is completely critical. So thank you very much. And I think this is what a testimony here, right? To show up wearing the wrong color, wearing the wrong color gear. Maybe. We don't have a number on the building. Julieta? Mr. Crosby, Alfred Crosby, do you have some comments?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you for the care, for the leadership that you bring to the Team PUD every day. And congratulations on defending your dissertation. That is a huge accomplishment, and I would like to hear more about your research and the topic of your dissertation in one time. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, I use it for a very good reason. What is industrial and organizational psychology? It's on the information we were provided, and I read it, and I didn't have time to look it up, but it must have been.
It's in the psychology of the workplace. So my discipline is really around leadership behavior and the impact on performance in the workplace and that sort of
Wow, perfect fit for us. No, not that we need it. And your work on the employee engagement, whatever that is that right? Employee engagement survey work. Cougar, oh, me to stand next to you. But I really appreciate it. And I've got pretty extensive background here with the utility. And we get talent like you, and we want to keep it. I hope we can keep you engaged and busy. And what engaged and busy, and where did she go? Thank you for joining us this morning. Enjoyed it. Do you have anything to say to me?
I mean, I don't really have anything planned, but just I appreciate everyone coming and for all of the support and, just that someone took time out of their day to think of me for this and kooks. We've got a few things to give you here. So I'll start out. Tony can give you those too. So we've got a gift certificate for $125 to Amazon.
Well,
They probably have food here.
that keeps and the plaque you can put in your workstation if you so choose. Or perhaps you have a place at home.
Trophy case, man.
And I get to do ta-da! Wow.
Okay.
What? Very good.
Here, let me take these two and let's take a picture of you with your trophy. And you have some family here today, maybe? Mom, and then dad.
He's down the hall, Matt.
He's out in the hall.
Okay.
Would you like to come up and get a picture, and
Get a
we'll take
picture.
one with us, and then we'll step away and you and your mom. Is that okay?
Yeah. Is he gonna ignore it?
No.
Yeah,
Sure. Oh, you want all of it?
Yeah. I'll get all of you and then just Matt.
You.
Thank you. I can't miss this opportunity.
Let's take.
Congratulations, Matt. Absolutely well deserved. And go
Cougs. Got an end there, I guess.
I'm a cult member. Congratulations.
Remember, oh, I like
Yeah.
that. I didn't remember that.
Been this way for a while. All of us.
Sorry about that. You mustn't. You stay.
You're welcome to stay. Oh, yeah, it is well deserved.
I had to do
I was going to say, I'm going to take it. Yeah.
Only if you're Elstrom with a good picture of that.
I
invite you got changed.
Next is item two, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on today's agenda? Please state
your first and last name for the record. So first up, we have Mr. Jimmy Castro. Castro, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for coming today.
Good morning, Commission, the public. My name is Jimmy Castro. I'm from the Bay Area. I'm a federal retiree. I've lived in the Pacific Northwest 6 years in Salem, Oregon, 3 years in Lacey, Washington, and 1 year now in Everett here. Today, I'm just something that I've written for the commission and Bud and the electric. Bud, commission and Bud. Introduction, Jimmy Castro, May 26, 2025. Moved to Everett, Washington on Memorial Day at Woodhaven Apartments on Valor Avenue, 47th Street, Everett, Washington, 98203. June 1st, 2026, Jimmy Castro moved to Bavin Property Management, South Everett. For PUD, the rent, I've had to pay $1,800. Plus electric and PUD comes to an extra $200. That's about $2,000 a month for rent, electric, and PUD. Body, all the meantime, gas 90% of the time. Jim Castro, a medical researcher, pruned, gardened, and cleaned up Woodhaven and 46th Street that had COVID and a killing field of dead bodies that stunk and smelled. Bavin Property Management pruned, cleaned, and gardened the mess there also. Woodhaven Apartments and Bavin Property Management gassed about 90% of the time. Conclusion. Must have rental control pricing and PUD electric control pricing also. The last 10 years, public health in the Pacific Northwest, in Salem, Oregon, and Lacey, Washington, and Everett, Washington, a miserable F or D plus. The rental and public utilities of Salem, Oregon, and Lacey, Washington, and Everett, Washington, F or D plus. We must do better now and in the future to better living conditions and controlled pricing of PUD electric and public health, medical, dental, and vision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Castro.
Thank you.
Is there any hands up online? Seen any? Move to item 3, our consent agenda. 3A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of January 20, 2026. 3B, bid awards, professional service contracts, and amendments. 3C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I
move. Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? There is your hand. Let's see what your hands are. Commissioners, do you have any questions? Commissioner Altamirano Crosby, do you have any questions?
I have none, thank you.
I do have a question, and I understand why, but on RFP 251568-HL, Integration Services Asset Lifecycle Accounting Solution and Mobility Solution. It looks like the best proposal started in mid-2005. And through the process, it looks like from the original estimate, it's gone up considerably. And I understand why, with the background, but if we could explain to the public the difference.
Good morning, Christy Sterling, Chief Information Officer. That's an excellent question. The early estimate was very early, a very early estimate. And it was based loosely on other upgrades to the SAP S4 platform. We spent, since that early estimate that we submitted, we've spent more than a year with a deep dive into the architecture and the complexity of all of the different modules that we have with SAP to understand which ones, which parts of the system will be upgraded and which parts have to be replaced. And so in doing that, there's a few reasons why the ultimate contract for this system integrator is significantly more. One, there's been a great period of time, and there is some upward pressure on inflation on consulting. We see that, and we will continue to see it, particularly as the final utilities start to migrate off of this SAP old platform. And just cost of consulting is going up. So that's one part of it from where we started a couple of years ago. Probably a greater part of the influence on that is the scope is just increased for various reasons. As I said, we've done a deep dive into the architecture, and there are certain key aspects of it. For instance, we're one of the few utilities that used a module called Asset Lifecycle Accounting. And that has to be replaced. It's no longer supported by SAP. We had a couple of different options. One was to develop and utilize a solution that this vendor, Cognizant, actually developed and supports. And it's right-sized for us versus going out and buying a large SAP financial model and redoing all of our financial systems behind that particular one. So we think this is a better option. That's one reason. And then added scope. We added a third phase to this project to look at and utilize the new technology that we're getting and really to address efficiencies and pain points that we have in how we use the system today. So after we do this massive upgrade to the new platform, then we are also going to take that opportunity and then start to really fine-tune it to what we need and address some of the existing pain points on time entry and mobility in a couple of other areas. So higher costs with consulting, add scope to address some of the gaps that are going away with the new product, and some additional scope at the end for us to really maximize the use out of the solution that we're using. So all of that resulted in the bigger contract. What we would see without this added cost is we would probably have several other contracts to address the scope of work. So
something together.
Yeah.
No, I thank you. I have to bring much direction of these.
This is
enterprise wide.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, just to clarify for the public, this is the hub of all of our technology. So virtually all of our processes that utilize technology go through this SAP solution. If it's not directly supported by SAP in the workflows, its systems are integrated into this. So it truly is our technology hub for the district. And that's why we see this. I will say that what you see here is the original planning estimates that we submitted. And we show that as a practice for transparency. However, when we were here in October presenting, what we presented to you as far as the estimates at that time are in line with what this bid came up to.
All right. Thank you. So therefore, it's in the budget.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it looks like you really went through an extensive process of applicant evaluation.
Yes. We had a broad team of users and technology experts that really did a deep dive into evaluating this particular vendor or consultant. And we looked at a broad range of consultants that were leading the way. This particular consulting firm has done many, many of these upgrades. So we're very confident with their experience.
Thank you.
Commissioner Altamirano-Crosby, any questions for
Cynthia? No, thank you. Thank you so much for all the explanation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments, commissioners, on the consent agenda? Okay, hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Next, item four, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This item is for the board and our CEO General Manager discussing some issues among ourselves and with PU staff. Good morning, Jones.
Good morning, Commissioners. First up is Ryan Collins with our legislative update. Morning, Ryan.
Morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Ryan Collins, the District State Government and External Affairs Specialist 3. Today, I'll be walking you through the latest key legislation report for the 2026 session. All right. This is just a regular update on the bills that we have identified as key legislation for this week. And just as a quick reminder, updates that were previously briefed legislation appear in bold on the slides in front of you, and new legislation is identified with a yellow tag in the upper right corner of the slide. My goal today is to highlight what's new since your last meeting and give you a clear sense of which proposals have the greatest potential impact on PUD and our customers. As we're entering week four of the 60-day session, we are approaching the first key milestone of the policy committee cutoff, which is tomorrow, February 4th. This first deadline is important as it serves as a narrowing function for the legislative process. All bills that have not moved out of their respective policy committees are no longer eligible to advance. As of this report, 8 bills have risen to the level of key legislation for the Commission's awareness. 3 of these bills were included on your January 20th report, and 5 are new to this report specifically, and I'll spend most of my time on those 5. Before diving into the individual bills, a reminder of how we evaluate legislation for inclusion is 1, high impact potential operations and for our customer programs, the likelihood of passage, and visibility with these proposals within the community, especially related to reliability, affordability, and safety. And at any point, please feel free to stop me for questions. First is Senate Bill 6008, which would create a residential battery incentive program administered by the Department of Commerce. As introduced, it would also require large utilities to implement a flexible demand program to support the use of batteries. Since introduction, we've been in close conversation with the bill's proponents. Through that engagement, we've reached clear consensus on several key refinements that address our concerns, including ensuring that the program is voluntary for utilities rather than a mandate, covering administrative and implementation costs within the state grant itself so there's no additional cost to the utility, and then also establishing flexible and achievable income eligibility targets that reflect real-world decisions and designs that we need to make. Well, the bill unfortunately doesn't look like it's going to be moving forward this session since it is not scheduled for a vote with a cutoff just tomorrow. It's unlikely to advance for the rest of the session. That said, the refinements that we got to with the proponents are a net positive for future discussions if the legislature decides to want to revive this.
Can you follow up? But there was a last point that you made about income levels.
Yes. Not a problem. So within the bill, there's an income threshold at 40% of the incentives funding needs to go to incomes of a certain level or below. The way that the language is written is that could potentially be a barrier as opposed to a target. And so we were working with the proponents to ensure that the language itself reflected the intent, which is that these are the dollars are going to the most in need, and again, not a barrier as opposed to exactly. Next is HB 2275. Okay, perfect. I did for it, which would create a state wildfire fund. The fund would be mandatory for investor owned utilities and voluntary for consumer owned utilities like Snohomish PUD. Since I last reported to the commission, the bill received a public hearing on January 21st, where we submitted written comments and signed in as con. Addressing wildfire risk requires a comprehensive approach built around 3 essential elements. Establishing wildfire mitigation funds or mitigation plans as a recognized standard of care, ensuring robust insurance and reinsurance frameworks that reflect evolving climate and liability realities. And then last but not least, the state increasing significantly the investments they need to put towards wildfire resilience, including mitigation and suppression capacity. All three components, not just FUD itself, are essential to create a comprehensive, fair approach that protects both the public and the PUD and the PUD's customers. Last week, the bill sponsor reached out to all the different stakeholders and announced that she does not plan to advance this bill any further this session. And noted that she's going to have monthly interim discussions with stakeholder group on the topic going forward. We are planning to stay engaged in those groups as the discussion evolves over the interim. And again, we're anticipating something more like this in 2027. But barring unforeseen circumstances, this bill will not be included in the key legislation report going forward, since the bill will no longer be considered.
I'm sorry. I have a question. As a Snohomish PUD position, I see these concerns. What concerns do we have?
So the concerns we had, again, is that just a fund alone wouldn't necessarily tackle the larger problem of wildfire. We think there are multiple areas that we need to focus on, again, ensuring that the wildfire mitigation plans are seen as a standard of care, as well as, again, additional investments in mitigation and resilience, none of which was included in the bill. And so that's mainly where we came, where we're coming from, that this falls short of a comprehensive solution.
Thank you.
Does the Utilities Commission weigh in on those?
The UTC does weigh in on bills. If you're going to, I'm assuming the next question is, where are they on this?
Yeah.
I will have to double check.
That doesn't matter, but sure.
No worries.
Yeah, thank you.
Not a problem. Turning to SB 6050 and its House counterpart, House Bill 2296, which, as introduced, aims to support customer generation technologies like plug-in solar and meter-mounted devices. This past Friday, the bill was amended and voted out of the committee, which with specific changes focused on tightening some of the safety requirements, most notably expanding certification standards for plug-in devices and adding customer notification requirements. Although this is still outside of the interconnection fee that we've been pursuing. For meter mounted to the devices, the new draft would give utilities clearer authority to address non-compliant equipment, including charges, and some of these changes are ones we've also been seeking. If the bill continues to move forward, I believe it will be further narrowed, given certain safety concerns raised by both the Department of Labor and Industries and IBEW on the plug-in solar provisions. As such, we're anticipating additional changes, and we will remain in the under review position.
Well, I guess my concern about this bill is, even if it gives utility approval, the customer is not going to understand. Well, your customers are needing utilities. If they're allowing such a thing, it potentially get back feed in and injure workers, and we might be, and our customers aren't necessarily going to know. If it's got a plug-in, you can pretty much assume you can use that anywhere in the nation. So I guess that's what concerns me, is it? It's a safety thing. I think it's a fascinating idea for a device for people to be able to get into solar at less cost without having to bolt things on the roof and stuff. But
I completely agree. We're very supportive of customer choice, but not at the detriment of safety for both our employees as well as our customers.
Yeah.
The safety concerns were the main thing that was raised by the labor and industries and IBEW specifically. And so, again, I wouldn't, if this does move forward, I would anticipate that be the focal point of changes going forward.
Yeah. No problem.
I have a question regarding safety,
yes.
Too. I'm sorry. Could you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. If this pass, I mean, how will the utilities, we are going to make sure that being consistent and the safety and across all devices, I mean, if they're going to stay in the installation and all that. So I don't know. I'm thinking about it too. So could you explain a little bit, or something that they're going to talk about it? I have no idea. And also if is going to increase any cost for these requirements for utilities. So I don't know.
Sure. Let me take that question in two parts. So first, I think one of the main points of comments that we've been submitting to the sponsors specifically on how the utility would incorporate these types of devices into our operations. That's why we've been pushing the sponsor to loop this back into the interconnection process. We're happy to have a discussion on what a more expedited process might look like. But there's a reason we do this, and it's not just for to create more paper. These are our opportunities to check if these devices are safe, if they are reliable, as well as ensure that they're going to connect to different parts of our grid in the appropriate way. We have different types of transformers out there. Some of these transformers may be could potentially overload with these devices on them, while others may not. There's a lot of different variables that go into this. And so this is why we're continuing to push the sponsor to put this back into the interconnection queue that the utility uses. On the cost collection front, we did seek amendment changes, particularly with the meter mounted devices provision that would allow the utility to capture any cost of service for install if we had to go out and change any of our equipment related to the use of these devices, as well as remove these devices if they interfere with our equipment going forward. Those changes were included. And so from a cost perspective, we feel much better in terms of our ability to capture those costs and have been ensure that the customer is paying for those costs.
The customer has to pay.
Do these devices exist?
They do, yes. Like the balcony solar one, it kind of looks like a blanket that you would hang over your balcony, and then again just plugs into your 120 outlet.
And this is something you can buy.
It's something you can buy. A couple other states are looking into this. They're readily available at the EU. This has been one of the things that the committee has been looking into.
To your point, I do wonder how they brought the experts in, but how this would meet National Electric Code and comply with those standards. It just intuitively doesn't make sense when you would have a generating device on the load side of the meter with the ability to backfeed.
Yeah.
And not just backfeed us and onto our system, but backfeed, you know, it's a fire risk or hazard. And
down lines, and children crossing over all the things.
Oh, just interesting.
I just kind of understand how the EU doesn't.
That's one of the things they're trying to investigate a little bit more. They led us to try to figure out exactly how this is working in the EU and how it would potentially work here. But John is absolutely right that the National Electric Code has not been updated to reflect some of these devices. And that's a big thing that IBEW is particularly hung on. All right.
And I'm sorry. Thank you. And I have one last comment or question regarding the cost. I mean, for the public utilities, but what about it, the cost in order to integrate this device that going to increase the cost for our constituents, our customers, if this pass?
So as the bill is currently drafted, we would be able to, again, any installation or removal of these devices because of safety or reliability concerns for our equipment would be borne by the customer, and we would be allowed and authorized to shift that cost of service to the customer if we're required to.
Okay, thank
you.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think this is going to hold on.
We'll see what happens. It's again, we're about a third of the way through session, still two thirds to go, and time is moving faster than I think a lot of the sponsors understand. All right, new to our key legislation report is House Bill 2515 and its Senate counterpart, Senate Bill 6171, which are aimed at regulating the energy use of data centers and cryptocurrency operations. A rise in electricity demand from these large customers is prompting concern amongst lawmakers about the potential impacts on residential rates, the state's clean energy targets, and long-term resource adequacy without proper guardrails. The proposed legislation defines emerging large energy use facilities, also known as ELEUS, say that 10 times fast, as customers who are using over 20 megawatts or more and are classified under the North American Industries Code for data centers and cryptocurrency. So it's a very narrow definition. It would require, the bill would then require electric utilities to establish a rate structure that would protect existing ratepayers from development of and the energy costs from these emerging large energy use facilities. Further, the legislation would require utilities to adopt a tariff or policy framework to for emerging large loads by October 26th of this year, or excuse me, October 1st of this year, to include certain provisions such as long-term service commitments, such as a 10-year contract, financial assurances to guard against stranded costs, exit fees, and certain provisions that define curtailment provisions in certain circumstances. In addition, the bill also, in the current version of the bill, it adds an expedited clean energy obligation for these large users under CETA and would require them to submit annual load forecasts and sustainability reporting to their servicing utility as well as state agencies. Finally, the bill provides proposes a per kilowatt hour fee on these loads to support statewide energy assistance and workforce development programs. From a rate making perspective, PUEs already have broad statutory authority to set cost recovery structures for large customers. This bill does not replace that authority. Instead, it requires each utility to adopt a formal policy or tariff specifically for emerging large loads. This requirement is the bill's primary limitation on the utility. While the bill is still in draft form and will evolve, the intent is to maintain local control while ensuring that PUD has a clear, durable structure for managing the costs and environmental impacts associated with these rapidly growing customer buses. As of this report, the bill has moved in a direction that reflects several of Snohomish PUD's key priorities, including cost-shift protections and flexibility for consumer-owned utilities. This is still a work in progress, and we will remain focused on, one, preserving our flexibility to design tariffs tailored to our local systems conditions, ensuring cost recovery tools do not become overly prescriptive or restrict our ability to negotiate project-specific needs, gaining clarity on how new clean energy mandates may impact the PUD's ability to serve future load, and ensuring the utility can manage the long-term impacts of large loads on infrastructure and resource adequacy. Both bills are scheduled to be voted out of the committee this week. The sponsors actually did yesterday and passed out of the House. The sponsors have indicated that there are additional changes to be anticipated as the bill advances. Pause there, since I know this is a big discussion right now.
It's a lot in the
bottom line, we maintain our local control.
Bottom line, we are required, we will be required to create a new class for these customers, but underneath that class, we retain our local control.
Which I think we're probably doing.
Correct. Yes. We're in the process of this.
These are some great aspirations. We certainly want to protect our customers from new large loads. It also seems to assume that we would be able to supply the energy for big large load. Doesn't really you see. I don't really see in there where we can. I see that we could curtail, but so it doesn't seem like it necessarily fits for the utility. Just for that item alone.
Correct. I think by and large, this is a national conversation that's happening. There's lots of different facets to how potentially to tackle this. I think the legislature is primarily focused on the customer protections piece. The Section 6, which is the new energy mandate, is an attempt, and it's an interesting concept in terms of trying to bring on new generation that would have to meet CETA's requirements, but also on a very expedited timeline. So they're kind of the intent behind the bill is to have them, these large energy use facilities, be a partner in bringing on additional resources. So the devil's in the details.
Is the concern that the bill sponsors have, is it the investor in utilities transferring cost onto customers?
I don't think there are concerns specifically between the two types of classes. I think generally speaking, what they're reading in the news is the potential for these cost shifts to occur regardless of the type of utility.
They do approach the language within the bill approaches COUs and IOUs differently given our governance structure. And we've been intimately involved in ensuring that the proponents understand exactly how the COUs work and the type of flexibility we need to implement these effectively. But we also do agree with the intent that growth should pay for growth. Current ratepayers do not need to subsidize these large loads.
I would just be concerned if there's anything that affects our ability to make a rate or to make a plan with a customer. I don't know. It's just.
Yeah, and we'll come back and have a little deeper dive on, you know, kind of where we're going to go with our large load policy. Yeah. But the most important thing is, again, local control or our ability to control how we structure, you know, the purchase power agreements, who's going to pay for the capital investments, all of those things.
Is the last bullet center column?
Yes.
The last sentence there. Is that the state trying to add money to its coffers?
Yeah, so the imposing of the half a percent.
A nano percent.
Yeah, so it is, in essence, another it would be a new revenue stream for the state to fund, and it's specifically within the bill would fund our like utility weatherization projects or weatherization programs, bill assistance.
Not just ours,
but it would be the whole thing.
Commissioner Ferrara Crosby, do you have any questions on this bill?
No, thank you. They already asked a few things that I was thinking about it, but thank you so much.
Well, the good news is this will stay on your key legislation report. It is probably one of the more noteworthy bills we're following this session. So more to come.
The last bullet is interesting that I think about it. What was the annual fee to support energy assistance? So we don't want it to affect other customers, but we think it might. But we're going to collect a fee, which is not our concern. If they collect a fee, it'd be good for our customers. But it's just interesting.
So I think the fee, if it's helpful just for clarifications, would be taxed on the facility itself, not through the utility.
Right. But my point is, if you build it so that you don't harm other customers, then why have a fee to collect money from the other customers?
They want to add it to coffers for them.
But it's great for our customers.
Well, not just ours.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Next is 2151, which you may be wondering why is actually on this list. Since the core purpose is primarily, it's a housing bill, it simply updates some of the RCWs to adopt national standards for factory-built structures. However, importantly for the PUD, we sought a narrow amendment to the bill to exempt certain utility-owned prefabricated enclosures from the Department of Labor and Industries approval process. This issue was first raised by our substation colleagues over the summer due to a delay that they were experiencing with the new substation project. As they highlighted, under current law, unoccupied prefabricated enclosures on utility property are treated the same way as habitable factory-built structures, which triggers this, it's an occupancy trigger threshold and adds additional permitting requirements when that threshold is met. Unfortunately, the statute doesn't provide clear distinctions for how utilities use these structures, which are not habitable on our projects. They are restricted access enclosures used solely to house electrical equipment, or in the case of the Arlington microgrid, energy storage systems. If this bill passes with the amendment now included, it would be a positive and practical change for the district supporting faster timelines for deploying critical energy projects. Good thing is, on the Senate side, the amendment's supposed to be adopted this morning, and seeing no additional challenges, this bill hopefully will become law, and I will hopefully have additional positive updates to share on this one. Next is SB 6004, which does not appear to, unfortunately, be moving forward this session. In short, the bill would give utilities like Snohomish PUD more tools to participate in renewable and non-emitting generation projects by aligning definitions of our current contracting authority to those defined under the Clean Energy Transformation Act, also known as CETA. This was an Energy Northwest bill that you may have recalled earlier. Because it would give us more flexibility and more tools, we did sign in support during last week's hearing. But as of today, the bill is not scheduled for a vote out of that committee, so it likely is not going to advance for the 2026 session.
What, in your opinion, is the reluctance around?
I think there is a general reluctance about how this bill may provide additional incentives for nuclear. There are groups that are pretty anti-nuclear, and I think given the short session, that was enough.
Yeah.
Next is Senate Bill 5644, which is a reintroduction from last year. You may recall that this bill will create a new state entity, the Washington Electric Transmission Authority, and authorize it to support statewide transmission planning and identify high priority corridors. The bill also includes targeted State Environmental Protection Act, also known as SEPA, categorical exemptions for certain transmission reconductoring and upgrades on existing transmission lines above 115 kV. While there has been a lot of interest in this proposal, given the transmission constraints and the reason, the near-term impacts to the PUD remain minimal. Were this bill to pass, as currently drafted, the main impacts would occur at the regional level, as this new entity starts to engage with regional actors and transmission service providers within the larger Pacific Northwest region. There are several stakeholders actively debating the details of this bill, and as that work continues, we're going to continue to closely monitor the language to understand how this new authority would align with existing regional transmission land use structures. Absent any major changes, we're going to continue to stay neutral on this.
This is sort of authority involving this bill.
It's we've been very focused on the planning components of the bill to ensure that there's no additional ripple effects. But again, most of the impacts would be at the regional level.
Right.
I have a question. I read in the bullet points. The bill will establish defined tribal notifications and cultural resources. What that means, significant cultural resources?
That's a great question, Commissioner. So the bill has been part of the larger stakeholder group, is a number of tribes. They have been very interested in ensuring that there's tribal notification as well as additional outreach provisions to the tribe in a more formal way, to the tribes in a more formal way. That's what those bullet points are getting at. If there's a specific detail you would like, I'm happy to get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
This cup half empty with a hole in the bottom. My comment. doesn't this just add another layer of complexity? I mean, we want to get some transmission built. To me, if that's another layer, and you're mixing IOUs and investment homes, which have their own set of meaning.
As we've been telling the bill sponsors, there's less of a planning problem. There's less of a financing problem. There's a shovels in the ground problem. There are categorical exemptions that this bill does touch upon, which would help that in the shovel part a little bit more. The planning part, not as much. All right. Finally, HB 2373 would standardize and expand requirements for low-income bill discount programs across all electric utilities in Washington. While the PUD already has a long-established bill discount program, this bill would aim to standardize programs around the state. As introduced, the bill would require tiered monthly discounts, additional enrollment options, expanding reporting, and demonstrating progress each biennium towards reducing customer energy burden. While the PUD already exceeds many of these expectations reflected in the bill, we are reviewing it carefully to ensure it aligns with our broader affordability and weatherization strategy. As Jeff Feinberg and some of our folks over in Energy Assistance have kind of mentioned, energy assistance programs are essential, but they are not just, they're just one part of how we support customers with the greatest needs. Many households benefit from longer term solutions like weatherization and energy efficiency upgrades. And we want to ensure that these new requirements complement, not constrain, our ability to deliver that full range of service that best reduce energy burden. The bill received a public hearing on January 20th, but it does not look like it's going to be moving forward this session just because it has not been scheduled for a vote this week. As such, we will also anticipate this one falling off the legislation report going forward.
I guess, you know, my only concern is, I'm proud of the work that you do for our customers, and we make that choice to do it. But I can imagine there's public utilities that are public elected and want to support their communities differently. And it's sort of, so it doesn't really concern my local control, but I'm sort of concerned potentially for their local control. We talk a lot about how we serve our customers as we need them. So we may invest more in Camano Island because we have more challenges there, right? So we get to decide what we do and where we're going to do it and how we're going to help our customers. I'm curious where Waputa came in.
So on this one, Waputa was opposed.
Okay.
To your point,
let me guess.
To your point, there's a lot of variability in terms of how customers, how energy burden impacts customers. If you're in a rural area, that's different than an urban area. The different programs would be useful in different areas and different to approach those customers differently. And so that's been our primary point, is to ensure that flexibility remains. We're very proud of the work that we've done thus far for our bill discount program, as well as expanding into other areas like weatherization, like energy efficiency, like the HEARS program that the state has. We've been very fortunate from the state's perspective to implement that. And so there are lots of options that can get us there, and we want to ensure that we can use all of them.
And not to say that I certainly believe that every utility in the state has customers needing help.
Yeah.
So. Well, and depending upon the geographic area, too, it may be financially very difficult for certain utilities.
Yeah.
That probably have a higher number of those that would qualify for a discount.
And I know there were utilities that,
and not the revenue discount,
that chose not to take some of the money that came from the, I can't remember, the carbon tax program.
Is this
aimed at that?
This bill, no. This one would actually be funded. Would specifically require the utility ratepayers to fund their rate paying programs. There are other low income bills that you may see again this year that would tap into that Climate Commitment Act funding as a state resource.
Interesting.
Well, with that, that is my update for this week.
I'm sorry.
As always.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm just curious, who is going to get the funds for this if they pass? You know, I mean, I don't know how they are planning to do that. No idea. The money.
Question.
Yes. Who is going to give the money to do all that? So as my question about funding and the cost recovery, so I don't know.
It's a great question, Commissioner. As written, this bill would fund this low-income discount programs from current ratepayers, from the current PUD's operational budget, as it's specified in the bill. There are other proposals out there that change that funding source, but this specific one would come from current ratepayers.
Which is how we fund now, correct?
Well, per utility, not state.
Correct.
Well, I think and Snohomish County PUD, we have an amazing program with discounts and everything. So I don't understand 100%, but I guess we see what happened. Thank you.
Of course, Commissioner, and happy to take any other questions if this doesn't make sense. That is the end of my update for today. As always, we'll continue to monitor these proposals closely and keep the commission informed as this session approaches this first major cutoff and the ones that precede it. With that, happy to take additional questions. Otherwise,
any more questions? Our greatest partner today.
Thank you, Commissioners.
You had us engaged.
Fantastic job, Brian. Okay, next we have Maureen Barnes presenting on the fish habitat property purchase in the Sullivan Basin. Good morning, Maureen. Good
morning. Actually, it's going to be Andrew and I, so I'm going to let Andrew.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Andrew McDonald. I'm the manager of Natural Resources. I'm joined this morning by my esteemed colleague from real estate, Maureen Barnes, and we'll be presenting fish habitat property purchase in the Sullivan Basin. Okay, the purpose of this presentation is to inform the board of the proposed fee purchase from Patricia Knowlton at 521 First Street, Sullivan, Washington, approximately 23 acres in the lower Sullivan Basin for $261,000, utilizing funds from the Fish Habitat Enhancement Fund. So today we'll be outlining the primary terms of the transaction and remind the commission that this transaction will be before you for approval by resolution at the February 17th meeting. First, a little bit of background on the Habitat Fund. It was part of the settlement agreement for the Henry M. Jackson Hydroelectric Project. Fish Habitat Enhancement Plan was established. As part of that plan, a fund, which we call the Habitat Fund or the Habitat Enhancement Account, was created to support future projects as determined by the Aquatic Resources Committee, or ARC, to improve habitat that is used by Salt River fish. It was initially seeded with $2.5 million, annual contributions of $200,000 plus consumer price index, started in year 11 and will continue through the term of the license. Currently, there's approximately $1.8 million in unallocated funds, and to date, we've spent or allocated approximately $2.2 million for various projects. I do want to share that and highlight our finance and treasury teams do a wonderful job investing this money into interest-bearing accounts. To date, that account has earned about $630,000 of interest. So the variety of project types that we're talking about with respect to this fund include habitat enhancements, water budget for flow releases, conservation easements, and property acquisition.
Can you tell us a little bit about the ARC and who's
Great question. So a little bit about the ARC. It's a comprehensive group of folks comprising the Tulalip tribes, federal agencies, state agencies, non-governmental organizations, just a wide range of stakeholders that participate on that committee and that help us implement the terms of our license in a real meaningful way for fish and wildlife. So for this particular property project, we've been, engaging with the landowner for several years. It wasn't until last year that the landowner indicated they'd be willing to sell. So at that point, Natural Resources staff developed a proposal to acquire the parcels and submitted that proposal for ARC consideration. The ARC approved the proposal back in December of 25 for acquisition, given its adjacency to the Salton River main stem, as well as a newly created side channel habitat in the lower Salton River. The intent is to restore riparian habitat by activities that could include removing cattle fencing off the property, managing for noxious weeds, and revegetating the site. The specific actions and prioritization will be determined by the ARC as further proposals move forward. So to orient the commissioners and the public to the lay of the land here. On the left, we have an aerial image. On the kind of the bottom right is the Highway 2 that runs through downtown Salton. You see the Skykomish River on the bottom right as well. Salton River empties into the Skykomish. And then about half a mile upstream is where you see these three parcels that we've identified for purchase. The total acreage is 23 acres. However, the largest of the three parcels is about 9.5 acres, and the smallest is about 5.5 acres. It's in real close proximity to the City of Salton Ospreys Park. Also abuts private land ownership, as well as the Volunteers of America. on the right, you can see a couple of photos from our new side channel that was constructed in 2024 as part of a Department of Ecology grant that the PD was awarded. Since the construction of that side channel, we've seen a variety of salmonids, both salmon and trout, adults and juveniles that are utilizing that new side channel that wasn't there prior to 2024. So it's pretty exciting from my view to see all that happen. And then you can also see in the foreground there some of the revegetation that's occurred along the stream banks there. That's what we call riparian plantings. And so hopefully over time that will provide stream shading to the side channel itself. So for us in Natural Resources, we're really excited about this. It's floodplain habitat, which is identifying these salmon recovery plants as critical for salmon and salmonids. And it'll be great to acquire this property for long-term conservation for both fish and wildlife. And in terms of wildlife, what we see out there on the landscape is a variety of species, including deer, waterfowl, animals, and other birds as well. So I'll pause here.
Questions, Christian? Commissioner Alexander Crosby, do you have any questions at this point?
No, thank you.
What about those three parcels to the south? Do we need those to build a successful project, or are we trying to get those?
I would like to acquire as much floodplain and riparian property as possible over the term of my career. I don't know who owns those properties to the south, immediately to the south, but further down below that 5.5 acre box is a 12 acre washed out parcel that I'm really interested in, but they're not going to sell yet. So always keeping our eyes on.
So I can't help but look at this. If we purchase these, would these have access to the river, the main channel, what side channels off of?
Thank you for bringing that up. So it's not shown on the aerial image on the left, but the new side channel runs through two of these parcels. To know, so thank you for bringing
great,
it up.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll turn it over to Maureen.
Thanks, Andrew. Good morning, I'm Maureen Barnes, Manager of Real Estate Services. I'm going to get into the meat and potatoes of this. So, talking about the purchase of it, the district has had a long relationship with the Knowltons, I guess with their property also. And we've always been looking to try and acquire these properties for further aquatic and terrestrial improvements. And it wasn't until, unfortunately, about approximately a year ago that Mr. Knowlton did pass away. And since then, Mrs. Knowlton decided that, yes, she was agreeable to selling. So in December of 2025, as Andrew said, we put together an option to purchase agreement, and we've done any due diligence that needs to be done. As Andrew mentioned, there's also been a lot of side channel work out there. We've actually done three different projects, one in 2010, one in 2022, and one in 2024. So we know the property very well. An option payment was paid in the amount of $10,000, and it will be applied to the purchase price if we complete the purchase. An appraisal was completed by an MAI certified appraiser, and it served as the basis for negotiating the actual purchase price. And the prices break down as follows. For the larger parcel, $100,000. For the 8.06, $86,000. And then for the smaller parcel, $75,000. And one of the things that is nice about the smaller parcel is that it does actually have access out to the road. So therefore, we won't need to go through the Knowlton's remaining property to get out there. We can access it any time. We'll put a nice road in. So our next steps are the option will expire at the end of March. As Andrew mentioned, on the 17th, we'll return seeking approval for the transaction and allowing us to exercise the option and complete the purchase. And again, the purchase was approved by our legal department. The option was worked on, approved by legal. District staff and the ARC committee have reviewed and approved the transaction. And I'd love both Andrew and I to answer any questions.
Any questions, Commissioner?
I have no questions. Thank you for the presentation.
And this is linked back to the licensing settlement.
Great deal. Thank you.
Thanks.
Brian, excellent job. Mine, Andrew, no, that is it for the conditions.
Okay. Next, we have item 5 for general manager report.
Yeah, some items to share. First off, water department has completed deployment, or water utility has completed deployment of AMI meters, with the exception of a final meter to be installed this week or tomorrow, actually. The 3-year project was completed safely, only 2 finger injuries, 1 that required medical attention, but one relatively minor. 6 months ahead of schedule and under budget. We also recycled old meters, valves, and pipe that were removed during the deployment, and got an extra amount of proceeds by turning that in, benefiting both the environment and the utility of $250,000. All 24,000 meters were replaced using internal resources. This is the example where we bet on ourselves. We brought the meter exchange program in internally. And again, as I mentioned, ahead of schedule and 10% under budget, which translates to about $1.2 million. So again, just to, the water utility absolutely crushed this. It'll be fun to celebrate with them tomorrow with the installation of the last AMI meter. I will also share that I, again, was the poster child for how valuable AMI is with having a water leak at the house during that cold spell. And actually, Jeff, in our Monday meeting last week, our ELT meeting, brought it to my attention.
Don't you mean the water leak again?
Again, yes. And I just love generating revenue for the water utility. It was a outdoor faucet, frost faucet, that I had not closed, and it froze and was leaking into the wall. Luckily, right in my office, so it was only a few feet away when Jeff brought it to my attention. And you know, it didn't take long to discover the leak. Got that all repaired over the weekend, and so. Another great advantage to having AMI and us being able to monitor it. We had a phone call, or my wife got a phone call on, it happened over the weekend, and that Monday, the water utility had notified my wife because her name is on the account. And there's also a few areas of opportunity for improvement on how we communicate to customers that will be coming for. So again, just the value, one of the many values of having the AMI system in place. Also, corporate communications, Kelly Stickney and Brett Smith presented on storm preparedness and outage planning at the Granite Falls Chamber of Commerce last Thursday, continue to focus on engagement with the cities and our communities. Last week, we announced a public call for artwork through an RFQ process for our new mural initiative aimed to enhance the Woods Creek Sustainability Center's hydroelectric powerhouse exterior and enrich the educational engagement. Mural will embody themes of local ecology, native flora and fauna, waterways, environmental stewardship, and clean energy. Artists will be evaluated on the basis of artistic merit, originality, public art experience, adherence to project timelines and budget, and alignment with thematic objectives. A designed employee selection committee formed via an interest application process will review submissions and recommend the artist to ensure the project reflects organizational values and community priorities.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
Will these be outside then?
Yes.
So yeah. They can only work in certain mediums, right?
Well, that's a good question. I'll have to follow up on that.
It can't be like on the back of the match book.
No tissue.
No tissue. No, I was just thinking it's going to be outside then.
It is outside, and I believe the con
be limited to certain kind of.
On one of the walls that you have as you walk down to the waterfall,
yeah,
I believe is where the mural will be. But I'll follow up.
Right. No, I'm sure it's going to be lovely. I don't need a follow.
Our customer and energy services key accounts team hosted a well-received customer coffee chat on January 21st with some of our largest commercial and industrial customers. The chat featured presentations by our power supply team on the transition with BPA to our new BPA contracts and our integrated resource plan. And last, and I suspect the commission may be aware of this or have already heard the news, John Harrison, BPA administrator, is moving to eWeb as their new CEO. I'm certainly excited for John. And again, to be able to continue to work with John. We are working with regional utilities and PPC to make sure the process involves all public power stakeholders and is merit-based. As for John's replacement, we anticipate an interim administrator will be named before a final appointment is made, as we've seen in the past. So,
are these appointments by the federal government?
Mm-hmm. Yep, by DOE. Yep. John did a lot of good work, but good to see him land in a good spot.
Yeah. Next gentleman.
Yeah. That's it. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions or comments on John's report, commissioners?
I have none.
No, thank you.
I just say, I want to say hats off to the water department. That's awesome ahead of time. I have a smart meter that's read in a dumb way for my utility, and I don't know how a customer can know if they have a small leak, really, without having.
I'll talk off the
bar beater.
They get electricity or do
they get water? No, water. It's like anything we've got.
I had that last summer.
Yeah.
Of course, my home is older, but it was running down. I thought, there's no faucet there.
It's wonderful. I imagine we found quite a few leaks for other customers too.
Yeah, but
they may not be the poster child. There may be someone else.
Yeah, and I think we've had, or we get somewhere in the neighborhood, I should have Jeff come up and talk about this, but 4,000 alarms,
wow,
which indicate a leak, a potential leak in somebody's system, and they do the analysis and then follow up with customers to just give them a heads up that, hey, you may have a leak going on.
Right.
And that's where we have an opportunity to enhance that. So instead of calling, we can send text messages, similar to like what we do, or emails, like what we do with the outage notifications. So continue to leverage that system.
Well, I'm sure customers appreciate that service. My water utility went to a smart meter, I guess. Well, you know, your water meters are under a big cement thing underground. And I got a humongous bill, and they had to install it properly. But they don't notify you until you get the bill.
Oh, yeah.
There's no notification. And it was showing 4 times usage over normal usage. What? I got a hissy too. But it's just that, you know, I said, isn't your practice to, if you see something that's way and annoying over what you see from that customer normally, don't you contact the customer? No. Also, they don't have an online, you can't go online and see your usage.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that the water department has really done a great job of. And again, we're still in a little bit of a manual process, but it will become more automated.
Yeah.
But they look at and review all of those alarms. So, you know, just to err on the side of caution and notify the customer, say, hey, we notice, you know, an increased usage or an increased amount of usage over a certain period of time, just to give them a heads up. And they may have been doing something, they have filled a swimming pool, and so they're aware, but they may not be aware. And so again, this is, great process.
That's huge.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're waiting till, you know, depending on when the meter was read, you know, if that leak started, you know, right after or the day after the meter was read, you're waiting 30 days until you would see something on that bill.
Well, and unlike electricity, you would expect times in the middle of the night where there's no water being used.
Mm-hmm.
Electricity, there's always some parasitic, there's always something on.
Yeah. So,
yeah. That's fascinating.
Real quick, I just wanted to jump in. Lisa Honeywell did confirm that the murals on the wall walking down to the powerhouse facing.
It'll be it'll really make a wonderful improvement on that.
Great idea. Looking forward to it. Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's a good question. Great question.
All right. Next is item six, public hearing in action. 6A, consideration of resolution declaring certain property interests of the district and a portion of certain real property, tax parcel number 27041300201500, situated in Linwood, Washington, to be surplus and authorizing the granting of a recreation and landscape easement in favor of Lane E. Tollefson. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
I'll now meet a public hearing. We have Marie Barnes available to answer any questions and provide the prior presentation if necessary. Are there any comments from the public regarding the resolution? Please raise your hand. No hands up. Are there any questions or comments? Commissioners, we were thoroughly briefed on this.
And on January the 20th, yes, we've been briefed.
I have no questions. Thank you.
There are no more questions. I'll close the public hearing. We'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Next, item seven, items for individual consideration. 7A, consideration of resolution revising the non-represented salary structure table on certain portions of the compensation programs. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Christy Schmidt is available to answer any questions regarding the resolution. Are there any comments from the public regarding this resolution? Please raise your hand. Hands up in the room or online. Commissioners, do you have any questions?
Resolution? I have no questions.
I have none.
I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Next, item 8, commission business. 8A, commission reports. Are there any reports, Commissioner?
I have none.
Well, last week we attend the wildfire preparedness and NWPPA. That was an amazing conference, and I'm glad I attend. There was a lot to digest. Very interesting topics there. So thank you so much for the support, and we have a good representation for the PUD team. Our attorney, Colin, he was part of the panel, and that was amazing. Thank you.
Next, 8B, our Commissioner Events Calendar. It changes to the Events Calendar. This is on page 101 of our packet. I'm going to the Everett Chamber at some point. Is that ringing any bells?
UBC instead. It was a curve.
Oh, okay. Any changes to the Event Calendar?
I
have none. Okay, we'll next move to our governance planning calendar. This is page 113 of the packet. Any changes to the governance planning calendar? We continue to have pretty light meetings. What are we not?
Well, we can strip a whole bunch
of. I know there's lots of work being done in the organization. We're just having these really. A year ago, we were going to noon. It's not like there's no changes to the government planning calendar. It is now 10:24 a.m. The board will recess into executive session to discuss the performance of a public employee under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meeting Act. It's anticipated the executive session will last approximately 60 minutes, and we'll take a 10-minute break before we start. So it'll conclude at 11:34. It will start at 10:34. Regular meeting will adjourn upon the conclusion of the executive session. It is now 11:34, and the executive session will be extended for an additional 40 minutes approximately, and will conclude at 12:14. It is now 12:12, and our executive session, we're going to extend it another 30 minutes from the previous 12:14. So our new anticipated conclusion time will be 12:44. It is now 12:41. We're going to add 15 minutes. This will be our third extension. And so our meeting is expected to conclude at 12:59.